Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, Huawei cheats on benchmarks. How slow is a Kirin anyhow? Intel Core i9 pricing is full of surprises. VR sales just slumped and Threadripper 2950X hits the market. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 482, recorded on September 6, 2018. Huawei cheats on mobile benchmarks?
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit.
Welcome to Twits, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twits Weekly Show that aims to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, most affordable, most expensive, and occasionally, well, actually, usually, we're aiming for the most accurate news about PC hardware, consoles, mobile, gaming, mayhem, NAS coverage, dogs, cats, new processors, the great 7-nanometer fight, all of it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Patrick Norton, here from the fantabulous Solopreneur Studio in beautiful San Diego, California. And joining me remotely from beautiful Fort Collins, Kentucky is Mr. Ryan Shrout, who you know and love from PCPer.com.
Is Ryan? It fair to say we are both joining remotely?
I think it's extremely fair to say. In fact,
we're
closer
by a significant margin, but yes. Yeah.
Well, technically, I'm joining remotely almost every time I'm not in the Twit studio.
Yeah. Yeah.
As are you.
Yeah. Luckily for us, bits tend to flow fairly quickly across the internet, enough for us to maintain some semblance of a conversation and do a show every week.
I still remember the first time you and I recorded live together in the Twit studio, and we got like 300 emails like, wow, the pacing was totally amazing. You guys should do that awesome. And we're like, yeah. So basically, we suck. Do it the way you did it that time. And yes, 100 millisecond round trip delay is problematic in timing in conversations.
I don't think Leo would go for the idea of flying me out every Thursday morning and flying me home every Thursday evening to do the show in person. But I'd get a ton of sky miles out of it. Right. So,
right. I'm feeling that would probably significantly reduce the profitability of this podcast and also probably end up with your ass getting divorced. Because the only thing worse than traveling as much as you do is adding a hard line in the sand about traveling every single Thursday.
It's true. Perpetuity. It's true. Yeah.
Don't even turn your head, or maybe turn your head once and then count how many PCs are in that particular, 115, 120 degree field of view.
I mean, if you count ones that are in some state of decomposition, if you will, some things that are like maybe it's missing a processor or it's missing a graphics card, I would probably say a dozen.
Yeah,
probably maybe more as I literally like my field of view. And this part of the room is blocked off by a big curtain. So, I mean, there's another. Probably that's Ken's side. He's probably got five of them over there in some various states.
It's time for you to spend some quality time on MMPC tech and get your painting on and start building custom PCs because you have the hardware for it.
It's true, but I don't have artistic capability or patience, which
you
is
and benchmarking. Because
Yeah, you don't have a choice there. Yeah, to be honest, I've always wanted to do a custom water cooled system that uses the rigid tubing, right? Mm-hmm. I think those look amazing.
They do.
They're impractical for upgrades and movement and bunch of different reasons and cost.
Most people don't upgrade their hardware as often as you do. I just want to lay that out there.
Yeah. And the truth is, I don't really upgrade my hardware that often for the machine I'm using. It's mostly because I said, if there's 12 computers that I can see from here, there's one of them has whatever I need it for that purpose within arm's reach almost. So I'm fortunate that way. But I could definitely see myself getting one really good one, keeping it for, a good 3-year time span unchanged. So I think that's a pretty good use of one of those highly modded custom devices. But, you know.
I know just the person to send you to when you're ready.
All right, fair.
Oh, my goodness. We took a look at this back in June on Tech Thing. You guys just did a write-up on it on PC Per this week. Jim Tanis did this one. The Synology DS1618 Plus, which is a NAS. You know, it's from Synology that does a pretty good job on the operating systems for their NASs, which I think is a big deal. And this is a pretty powerful one. It's kind of the high end of the home user or a pretty prime small business NAS. This is also, as Jim points out, pretty much immediately. It's pretty interesting that it has kind of an entry level, as he puts it, enterprise feature set. Big deal is a PCIe expansion slot, a 3.0x8 four-link slot, or an X4-link slot. And so you could possibly actually put in NVMe flash adapters, 10 gigabit Ethernet ports. But it's also a fairly powerful NAS, like 32 gigs of DDR4 memory. NASs are a nightmare to benchmark. I just want to say that right now. Because you literally, if a new NAS comes with new drives, you will often find them configured in things where they would put like two drives in a single like RAID 1 array, which kind of defeats the purpose of a 6-bay NAS, if you're asking me. But it's been interesting. The whole idea, or if you have, you know, a year-old or two-year-old NAS with 8 3-gigabyte drives inside of it versus a new NAS with 6-gigabyte drives inside of it, and the aerial density is considerably higher, or 6, you know, drive slots in it. I just want to point that out because I have a lot of respect for anybody that can test NASs without going insane, myself included, because trying to figure out the performance on them gets really, really interesting. And I would also like to point out most people obsess about the performance, obsess about the wrong performance because they're looking at, you know, sort of drag, you know, quarter mile drag race runs in terms of maximum bandwidth, but not taking advantage of the fact, like, you know, if you look at the back of there's 4 Ethernet ports on that. And, you know, it turns out you can actually, you know, set this up and configure it so that it is working to, you know, use each one of those Ethernet ports on, say, 4 different activities simultaneously without having to get into the expensive, enterprise grade routers on that one. A lot of expansion on this, 2 6 gigabit eSATA ports, 2 USB 3.0 ports, 4 RJ45 ports on there. I was really impressed with this. And one, because I'm a fan of Synology. I've been using their NAS boxes for a very long time. 2, quad-core Intel Atom C3538 CPU. Hardly a barn burner, but a considerable step up from a lot of the processors I've seen in NAS boxes. He got some pretty fantastic performance out of this, speaking of speed tests. Was it like 945.7 megabytes per second reads for sequential reads and like 520.8 megabytes per second on writes? That's workable.
It certainly is. Jim came away awfully impressed with it. Not only that, I was kind of impressed when he was going into the detail of it. So I've never used a Synology NAS before. The software in it, and Alan was raving about the software integration on it as well. And it actually supports natively a Plex server client too. So I kind of looked at it going, oh, it's got this Atom processor in it. What's it going to do? And if you're doing native output, I think he could get 5 up to 6 different clients running. If you're doing conversion, you could get 2 1080p conversions happening at the same time. Right. So, you know, not if you have a huge family, you're sharing with a bunch of your friends, but if you're using it for an in-home box and, you know, a couple of devices might be streaming off of it, it's a completely usable, workable, highly effective system for it. And that's, you know, there are other software implementations for it too. So, They're still expensive, and I think that's what that's something that a lot of people have trouble getting past is, like, this is a $799 device with no hard drives. So that's for some people that see it as literally just a hard drive rack. That's harder pill to swallow, but in reality, a lot of these devices are doing a lot more than that. Whether you're talking Drobos or Synologies or anybody else that is big in this space. And I think it comes out well. I mean, but by the time you fill that with hard drives, you know, depending on what capacity, I think it supports 72 terabytes total. So right.
You can basically daisy chain multiple boxes together. You can add drive boxes to expand them. But yeah, I think it's 72 terabytes with 6 gigabyte drives. That's not right. Because that's not... Sorry. I knew this when I reviewed it, but I can't remember it off the top of my head now. I want to say it's... I think it's 72 if you add the additional external storage boxes on that. I should double check on Synology.
No, 72 internal... And 192 raw with expansion.
There we go.
Yeah.
Which
is nuts, right?
It's nuts, but also you got to remember we live in an era where you can pick up 12 terabyte hard drives. They are not inexpensive.
Yeah, you can.
You can spend a tremendous... right. How many 10 terabyte drives did you buy for that 4K capture box?
Too many.
Yeah.
Too many.
An adequate mortgage payment in pretty much all of Northern California.
A 12 terabyte hard drive is going to be $450, right? So yeah. If you're going to fill this with 6 of them, you're talking $2,700 worth of hard drives.
Right.
Plus, you know, and then when you start looking at that, it's like, okay, I'm adding $750 for this box to maintain them all. It seems a little bit more reasonable. So, yeah.
I think the sweet spot when I was looking at these in June was an 8 terabyte drive ended up being about the best balance between expense or kind of cost per gigabyte and the maximum amount of storage you can fit in the box. Like 8 terabytes is the sweet spot for those drives for red drives right now. It's funny because I just did a segment on this week's tech thing about backing up a NAS offsite, which... if you have a Drobo device, for example, that plugs into your PC, which I have on my desktop at home, you can actually take advantage of something like Backblaze to back that up. It just treats it as another external hard drive. Mine just happens to have like 7 terabytes of data on it. NAS devices don't actually, most online storage organizations do not want you backing up your NAS.
correct.
on their, I mean, you know, uncapped.
I understand the reasoning. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm a big fan of Backblaze because I use them to back up my systems. They're inexpensive. I love the hard drive kind of reports they do quarterly. But if you take a look at this, there's kind of two different, you pay, and this is for pretty much every different vendor of this type. You're paying for your online storage and then you pay again when you download. And
right.
The other thing to think about is when you're talking about terabytes of data, I think I figured out for 10 or 12 terabytes, it was going to be, depending on the speed of your internet, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 hours to back that up. If, for example, it could run at the top speed of my typically 100 gigabit per second upload speed at my home. I bring that up because, if you're a wedding photographer or a videographer or you're storing massive amounts of client data or whatever it is, remember, backing up something of this scale offsite is non-trivial You may end up, wanting to buy, you may end up with, a NAS at the mothership and a NAS in the field office and having them backing data up. But it is something you should think about before you assemble, 72 terabytes of data and a storm comes. Because, these are kind of heavy when they're full of drives. I would also point out that if you are in that situation, you can pull the drive carriages out and very carefully pack them in a Pelican case and run those to the next town and then plug them into another enclosure after your house on floods. Possibly
I just checked
a true story.
Our back plays is 13.6 terabytes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
it did take a long time to back up.
Yes. But. On the flip side, you may start with 1 terabyte, which will be done in a few days. And then over the next year or two, all of a sudden you're like, hey, I got 27 terabytes up there. Synology makes good stuff. It's amazing. They have their new, they finally got, my understanding is they're your hyper backup programs. And that's kind of what makes Synology so nice is there's so many third-party kind of like plugins for the operating system that allow you to expand it. To be able to use the hyper backup, which allows you to do incremental backups based on your settings locally rather than, for example, in the cloud backup, having to let Backblaze do the versioning, which is an option, but not necessarily the best option for a lot of people. But it's cool to see stuff get supported. It's cool to see the operating system grow. It's cool to see them continually do updates. You know, yes, several years ago they got, you know, they got bit by some hackery activity, but they were also really open about that, and they're working really hard to maintain security. And I think anything that gets targeted, somebody's going to find a flaw in it, which is really not as cynical as that may sound, I swear. Huawei announces Kirin 980, not a beer, but possibly the world's first 7-nanometer system on a chip, passing Snapdragon. True or false, Brian?
Yes. Well, there's an interesting twist to this. Let me start with this. The announcement was actually pretty impressive. This is the first processor that will ship using the ARM Cortex A76 CPU cores, which are the ones that ARM announced earlier this year that portend to compete with Intel's, you know, IPC and capability, right? Now, obviously, there's going to be a difference in the thermal design of these versus those meant for like Windows 10 machines. But this is a high performance CPU core, kind of a new generation, start of a beginning shift for ARM as well. Also has the first SoC to use the Mali G76 GPU. So performance there. They've done some interesting things. The Kirin 980 is actually an octa-core part, but it's instead of divided in four big, four little, it's actually two big, two medium, and four little. If you look at that architectural kind of layout, it gives you an idea of what this is. You know, you've got your four Cortex A55s running at 1.8. They're the smaller, the most efficient. They're background tasks, music playing. You know, your screen is off, doing those types of things. But then you've got two separate divisions of the A76, and they've just been, you know, slightly optimized to, you know, when you run at 1.92, you can run at way lower voltages using way less power, but you still have very high single-threaded performance and two-threaded performance. And then when you need the absolute peak of performance, maybe you're gaming or you're doing some VR tasks or whatever it happens to be, you've got the two A76 cores that, you know, go up to 2.6 gigahertz. That does put them into a different level of, you know, power efficiency than the other ones. But having that mix, I think, is good. The question will be, does the operating system and does the SoC itself balance all of those cores accordingly and distribute the workload in the most effective manner, right? And does it move workloads across them as needed? And ARM has done a lot of work to make sure that's the case. We need to see if Android has done enough work to make that the case and that if Huawei has done it. They're claiming some pretty significant performance boosts. They're comparing it to Snapdragon 845, which started shipping in phones, you know, in the spring here. Mm-hmm. And it was announced last December. So about 30% better single-threaded Geekbench performance, 32% better efficiency in terms of performance per watt, according, you know, compared to the Snapdragon 845. And then if you look at the GPU side, just they're comparing it to their own part, the Kirin 970 before it, talking about 46% better performance and way, way better efficiency, they claim in 178%. This is all great information. It looks like a significant part. They have a neural processing engine in this that they say is, you know, 2x faster than what Apple is doing, although the benchmarks and metrics for AI processing and compute capability are hazy at best. Huawei integrates their own modem. They integrate their own Wi-Fi controller. They're basically doing what Apple is doing, but for the Chinese market. Mm-hmm. And I would say they're even a step ahead of them because of that modem and Wi-Fi integration and stuff that Apple still depends on third-party chips for. It's also worth noting, if people aren't familiar, the Kirin line of SoCs is only used in Huawei devices. It's developed by Huawei. Right. The silicon group is called HiSilicon. So any, you know, Huawei Mate 20 will use this. There's a new Honor phone that will come out, which is kind of their slightly lower cost line of phones will use one of these. So it's not like you're going to go out and find a Xiaomi or an Oppo or a Samsung or something using one of these chips. So it does limit you a little bit into where you'll find them in the real world. But they have been, over the last, I'd say, 3 years or so, very competitive, creating some interest and some competitiveness back and forth between them and Qualcomm in the Android space, even though the only place they're actually directly competing is for Huawei's own business, right? If Snapdragon came out with something that Huawei would go back and use that instead of their own in-house chips, Huawei does not sell to outside groups. So pretty interesting note there. But it does kind of tie in with the second bit of news. It started to come out with a couple, 3 days ago. There was a non-tech story, actually, that talked about Huawei cheating in benchmarks. Now, they were doing testing on the 970, not the 980, because the 980 is not out yet. But they found that in some graphics tests, specifically in some gaming tests, that the 970 was, yeah, you can scroll to that second graph there, shows you an idea of the performance delta in, quote, cheating mode and non-cheating mode. Whoa. And they were basically they were detecting when a benchmark was happening, and they would let it use a higher thermal dissipation than they would otherwise. Right. So instead of using 4.5 watts, they'd use 8 watts of power, which obviously in a short run test is, you know, it's usable, right? Like you can do that. The phone didn't catch on fire, the battery didn't explode or something like that. But it's not realistic because it's not what somebody's going to do when they're actually gaming, right? It's going to be limited. And what this tweet that I sent out was not about the non-tech story that kind of started the discussion down there, but it was actually FutureMark, which is now UL Benchmarks, delisted some Huawei phones from their 3D Mark and other benchmarks because of this. The P20 Pro, the Nova 3, and the Honor Play results were removed because of that graph that you see there. Basically, they did their own internal testing, and they created a different version of the app that, you know, basically presented itself to the operating system differently so that it wouldn't be detected by the custom OS on Huawei's phones. It was running the exact same workloads, but you can see the huge drop. You get a score of 2988 going down to 1930, for example, in these particular scores. And that's a big deal for them. And these benchmark companies, especially somebody like UL, who's been around forever, they depend on their ratings and you know, the fairness of their tests to be accurate. And this was not the case. They pulling devices like this is a pretty significant move for them. You know, they sent out an email blast, linked to their, you know, rules and regs for manufacturers to follow. They talk about detection and optimizations forbidden, and it was an impressive move on their part to do it. And I think a little bit damaging, pretty damaging for Huawei and the Kirin line, especially since they just made a big announcement about all these performance claims on their new chip. And now you kind of go, well, I guess we'll wait and see if that turns out to be the case.
Well, this level of cheating on a benchmark is something I haven't even heard of since back in the Sid Davis benchmark days. Those benchmarks were really insane because they had a huge influence on you know, what PC Mag used to call brand specifiers, people who made the decisions at large companies or, you know, in a house. And two, they spent a tremendous amount of money. They're this industry standard at the time. I mean, I literally was offered, it was a month before I realized it, when I sort of played the conversation back in my head and was like, wait a minute, that person just offered me $500,000 for a beta copy of the benchmark so they could prep their machines, you know, basically. And what they would do as soon as the benchmarks would release, everybody from Dell and Micron and Gateway and all these other PC companies that have been gone for a long time, you know, they would have their teams would sit down and rage through configurations till they figured out which ones did the best jobs for the given benchmarks. And the upside of that was the benchmarks were actually based on real world applications, real world applications that would not use up a single core on a contemporary processor. But back in the day, they were pretty challenging. And it was incredibly competitive. And, you know, some of the graphics benchmarks we call, you know, people were caught cheating, you know, basically, you know, and this is a relatively brute force, inelegant way of doing it. Like a benchmark is running on the upside. It's doing it. They're not, you know, they're not actually like lying and, you know, substituting information, but they are creating an unrealistic, performance expectation. At least if you think you should be able to run at that performance for less than the X number of seconds the benchmark takes. You know,
it's very similar. If you go back 15, 18 years, there was ATI was caught cheating back in the day. It was the Quake Quack thing. Do you remember this? Where, you know, Quake was the big benchmark, right? And Quake 3. And what they did was they did some optimizations specific for that game that lowered the quality of some of the texture maps or the anisotropic filtering at the time that was very important. And because the it was a time demo and it ran very fast. So it was hard for any person watching it to really see that the quality... Right, exactly. So what happened was people realized if you just simply rename the executable from Quake 3 to Quack 3 and did it, you would have significant impact on performance. And that's when people started to realize what was happening, and you know, they went back and changed things, and it's a whole different world. And you know, this is incredibly unfortunate. It's good that there are people out there checking for it. It's good that there are benchmark companies that are holding people, you know, their feet to the fire and taking them to task for these types of things. And it's something to watch for and keep an eye on as we move forward. We can think everything is above board and that, you know, we've solved all problems, but clearly not the case.
It's disappointing and it's frustrating. You know, you'd think this isn't happening anymore, but apparently it still is. But Well, people want to be competitive. There's money to be made. They want an advantage in the marketplace. Yep. And the reality is most people aren't really stressing their hardware in a way that they would kind of be able to, you know, manually detect the difference in performance. But props to the benchmarking company for, you know, really shutting the door down on this and trying to make it, you know, trying to, you know, keep it as a legitimate benchmark tool. We should also probably mention that Qualcomm and the Snapdragon is a sponsor of TWiT. So just so it's abundantly clear, we would be just as upset if anybody was doing this, not just
oh,
a,
for sure.
let us make this abundantly clear. Interesting report up on PC Mag earlier this week, or probably late last week. It all kind of blends together. Prices are leaking online for Intel's ninth generation processors. And writes Matthew Humphreys, quote, they are nowhere near as high as you'd expect for the chip giant's highest performance 8-core chips. And that's, of course, assuming these are the actual prices. So October 1s, that's the rumored launch date for Intel's ninth gen chips. Probably looking at a 8-core, 16-thread Core i9-9900K running at 3.6 gigahertz and turbo boosting to 5 gigahertz. That's the, I'm just quoting straight from Mr. Humphreys in that one and other places. And three stores leaked pricing information on the 9900K, the 9700K, and the 9600K. And Alza.cz, PC21.fr, and Informatica Zone. And so... they're looking at, you know, they converted the prices in euros to U.S. dollars, subtracted the VAT, so the value-added tax, and they came up with a Core i9-9900K priced out at $534. I think Intel hears Ryzen. I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, is... you know, the i7-9700K, you're looking at like $416, which is kind of a less attractive chip to me because it's 8 cores, 8 threads. And then the 9600K is 6 cores, 6 threads. So, you know, running at like 3.6 and 3.7 gigahertz, boosting up to 4.9 and 4.6 gigahertz. And that Core i5-9600K is running about $257. I'm very curious because traditionally, you know, Intel drops a new super cool gaming overclockable chip and we both go, wow, it's like $1,300. But this time they're, you know, if these prices are legit, you're talking about a very competitive price. So
eager to see.
Yeah. We wait with bated breath, ladies and gentlemen. Oh my goodness. You're probably waiting with bated breath if you've applied for a mortgage recently, and you're probably thinking to yourself, gosh, applying for a mortgage. Just hit me with a stick and, you know, cover the, it just, I'm trying to think of what's more painful than applying for a mortgage. And at the moment, words fail me, except for being stuck in traffic in LA on any given morning. Not that I did that recently, but I bring all this up because this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. And we should talk about buying a home for a minute. Interest rates are rising. You know, that makes things unpredictable. People are nervous, right? People get anxious because you're talking about a lot of money. You know, 30-year mortgage, that's a long time. It's a big commitment. So our friends at Quicken Loans, they're doing something to make you feel a little less nervous, to kind of dial back on the anxiety. They're calling it the power buying process. It's really simple. You answer a few questions. They check your credit for pre-qualified approval. And Quicken Loans is going to verify your income, your assets, your credit. Less than 24 hours. Fast. Fast and mortgage usually don't go together. They get you a verified approval. The idea, they want to give you the strength of a cash buyer. And once you're verified, you qualify for their all new, their exclusive Rate Shield approval. They lock your rate in for up to 90 days while you're shopping for that home. Here's where it gets really cool. If the rates go up, they keep your rate the same. But if rates go down, they drop your rate for that 90-day period. Interest rates go up, you're safe. Interest rates go down, you get a better deal. It's a win-win situation, which is something most people don't get. You know, it's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusion may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. rocketmortgage.com/TWIT. And we want to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Twit and This Week in Computer Hardware. And on behalf of anyone who's ever been emotionally scarred trying to get a mortgage. This is the paperwork, the examinations, the pain, the trauma. Maybe it's just me. The whole, you know, applying for car loans makes me want to burst into tears. Mortgages scales that up. RocketMortgage.com/twit. Make your life easier. AMD's Ryzen Threadripper 2950X now available for purchase for $899. You bought two, right?
No. not that I'm not saying it's a good deal. I still think so. This was, you know, the reviews went up, man, it feels like forever ago, I guess a month ago or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the only one that was for sale was the 32-core 2990WX that was a very good performing workstation part, but had a lot of, you know, I would say hiccups in the, if you were a general consumer gamer, only light on the heavily multi-threaded applications. 2950X is a much better part for that. It's better performance for gaming, easier. You don't have to go worry about disabling cores or going into game mode to get good gaming performance. Still offers, you know, 16 cores, 32 threads of compute capability, a lot of power there. And it launches at $100 less than the 1950X launched at, mm-hmm. but you get the advantages of the Zen Plus core, get the advantages of the higher frequency, and just better optimization for the platform over time. If we had to pick of the processors we looked at, this is definitely the one that gets the most attention, and I think deservedly so from the kind of audience that is paying attention. It's the mix of enthusiast / prosumer, right, as opposed to the pure kind of workstation user that might be interested in the 2990WX. It's just this week finally available for purchase. I'm curious about the staggered release of this, if it kind of, I don't know, lessens the excitement for those initial mm-hmm. builders or not, and that type of thing. But, you know, if you are waiting on the 2950X and looking forward to it, it's there. We still have yet to see, Ken pointed out today, that we still haven't seen the Wraith Ripper, which is that giant air cooler that they built for the second generation Threadripper parts. Not available for sale yet. That's not necessarily a huge deal because in our testing, it was less... the performance was lower with it than it was even with a, you know, 240 millimeter self-contained water cooler, right? Which is something that I think if you're buying this level of part, makes sense to have built in for your system. So, yeah, that's a good deal. And I'm just checking here. The 1950X is down to $711. So that's still a pretty good deal for it. So it's $180 difference between the previous generation 16 core 32 thread and the new one. Compelling argument to be made for either of those, I think. So depending on your budgetary restrictions.
Sorry. Budgetary restrictions are always problematic. What is a GPU market? I have no idea.
Well, it's shrinking is what it is. Oh. So this was a summary of John Petty research that is a JPR does tracks the graphics markets and has done so for a very long time. And they show that the GPU shipments were significantly lower for AMD and NVIDIA for this most recent quarter than the ones previous to it. AMD dropped or sold 12.3% less, while NVIDIA dropped 7% in that time period. Mm-hmm. This is obviously a result of the, let's say, shifting demand of the cryptocurrency and mining markets, if you will.
Right.
It was a wave that we knew was going to die down eventually. We happened to cross that in the Q2 of this year, and this is kind of the result of it. Now, keep in mind that in this diagram, this particular report is not about discrete graphics only. It is about all graphics, so it includes Intel integrated graphics, AMD integrated graphics. All that is in the mix. That's why, you know, Intel shows 67 and 70% market share there. That's just because of their integrated graphics being included. In case you're curious, it's an interesting number that discrete GPUs were in 32% of PCs sold, dropping over 6% over the previous quarter. So, again, another kind of significant drop. Does any of this surprise you?
No. I mean, you know, you went from the, man, I mean, it's crazy, right? So the cryptocurrency blows the market up. So every card they can find gets sold, which basically makes it impossible for gamers to buy cards for the better part of a year. AMD launches a new product that no one seems to be able to buy because they're out of stock for slightly different reasons. About the time all of those start to become back down in price, we start seeing the first rumors of the next generation cards, which, of course, we've talked about quite a bit, the 20 series from NVIDIA. Yeah, I'm not really surprised. I mean, you basically had the strongest GPU market, 3D GPU market, I think, in forever over the last year. It's certainly in terms of the amount of money that was made by retailers, but... I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. You know, a lot of people aren't gamers. Two, you know, the majority of PCs sold are laptops these days. So three, I think a lot of these numbers make sense. And four, I think we're still in a situation where most people never actually upgrade their machine. Five, that said, there's still an awful lot of GPU sales to be made. And six, I'm really curious to see what happens with PC gaming because... Yeah, I think the death of PCs and the death of PC gaming has been erroneously forecasted a lot in the, you know, pretty much in the, 8 years we've been doing this show. You know, about every 2 years, it's all over, it's all done with, there's no money to be made. And then, you know, a couple of years later, doom, gloom, you know, and then you turn around and something really cool happens that you can't really do with the same level of excellence. Yes, there are cheaper ways to do VR, but it looks a lot better. If you're attached to a high-powered PC, you know, there are less expensive ways to game consoles, but you're not going to get the leading graphics performance. And you know, if NVIDIA delivers on the RTX stuff, I think a lot of, I think it's going to be a, you know, either, you know, Xbox and so Microsoft and Sony are working a lot farther ahead on their consoles than I would think. Or there's going to be this huge kind of gap between PC gaming visuals and console visuals, but I don't know. It all makes sense. I mean, and even if, you know, I think it makes sense even without the insane explosion in the market last year. So, The other thing that you guys are talking about with graphics this week, Jeremy wrote up, graphics cores past and present, looking back at AMD's recent GPUs. It sounds
this is actually a coverage of a hard OCP story it was really well done, and it's something they had done with NVIDIA parts that I had not looked back on. But it's a lot of times we get people asking for this. You know, one of the things that we find when we do our graphics testing is that it's hard to include a lot of generations of products because the data presented can be very complex. We like to show a lot of data points, not just an average frame rate. We want to show frame times and we want to show frame plots. And when you get line graphs in there, suddenly having 10 data points doesn't make a lot of sense. But Brent and Kyle at Hard OCP do a great job of this stuff. They went back and looked at all the way back from the 290 to the 390 to Fiji to Vega and started looking at a lot of games actually and how performance improved over these. And it's pretty impressive. If you pick a game like, Battlefield 1, for example, and if you look at this stuff, you'll see this is more simply presented because it's a multiplayer game, so it only did averages. But, 25x14, ultra settings, you can see you get pretty good, I would say a small jump from the 290X to the 390X. And that, if you remember back to those days, that kind of made sense because it was a small architectural change. And then you go to 73 frames per second with the Fury X and then 94 for the Vega 64. And you start to realize that actually the Vega part was a significant jump for AMD's top level flagship products. It may not have appeared that way because of what it was competing with on the NVIDIA side, but this is in itself kind of showing the jumps that AMD has made in this regard. And there's, games in here, Crysis 3, Tomb Raider, GTA 5, all that stuff is in there. And then a lot of them do have larger plots in them, but even Crysis 3, you go from 38 to 60 in that generation, still showing that Crysis is a pain for modern hardware to really run reliably. So, yeah,
it's not be tamed.
No joke. It's good to have these retroactive looks at performance, give you a little bit of sense of scale, sense of advancement. It's easy to become jaded by new parts and say, oh, we only got 30% here or, generation to generation. But if you plot 30% over 3 to 4 years, 3 to 4 generations, you see that we've made a lot of progress. And especially if you see where CPU space on the Intel side just stopped for a while, these are runs and leaps ahead by comparison.
I'm okay with runs and leaps. It makes me happy. I like big jumps that makes my existing hardware look small and pathetic. Fills me with an urge to upgrade. Nova Yoga C630 WOS laptop first with Snapdragon 850. What do you think? I mean, are you excited about these laptops or are you tentative about these laptops?
I'm excited about them, but, I would say modestly so, right? I see the potential in this, and I used a Snapdragon 835 based HP machine for quite a while, and I had the Asus one as well. And the all-day the battery life claims and the connectivity claims are there. They're true. They're real. They're impactful. But the performance was what held it back, right? Performance and then to some degree application compatibility. The 850 is not the huge jump. It's not the move to the ARM A76 base core that we're going to see next year. This is more of a moderate increase, but it is, they claim 30% performance improvement on the CPU and GPU side. 30%, as we were just talking about, is actually a pretty big increase for a generation on generation improvement in CPU performance. Intel hasn't seen that in a long time, right? And AMD saw it after a 10-year window in which they were well behind what Intel could do. So I'm interested to see it. I've to test with it. I've seen the device itself in person, and it looks like a like a high-end flagship yoga device, right? Mm-hmm. If you looked at what Lenovo built for the Windows on Snapdragon stuff last year, it was a Mix. It was the Lenovo Mix 630 or something like that. Mix, it was some Mix device, right? So it wasn't part of their flagship line of devices. The Yoga is their flagship consumer line, and it looks and feels like it. It's a convertible 2-in-1. It's not a detachable, which I prefer the convertibles that rather than detachables. Because they're just a normal laptop normally, and if you feel the need to flip it over and use that as a tablet, you can. Similar memory configurations, storage configurations, 4 and 8 gigs for storage or for memory, 128 and 256 gigs for full size storage. UFS still on this, 13.3-inch 1080p display, 2 USB Type-C ports for power and DisplayPort output and stuff. So I think it will be an interesting device. I'm curious to see what the second generation is. I think most people are most excited about what the third gen will be when we start to get into, where they're claiming Core i5 levels of performance. But this is that stepping stone to it. So we'll see. Hopefully I'll have one in a couple of weeks. I hope so, at least. We'll see.
It would be nice if they lived up to the 22 hours of battery life.
Yes.
I would appreciate that. It would be nice. It would be very, very nice. Despite a sharp decline in VR headset shipments in Q2 2018, the market outlook remains positive, which is conflicting, but strangely sensible.
Yeah.
As is everything in VR. Conflicting, but it makes sense. What was IDC's
33%. Yeah. I agree with you that it is absolutely a kind of a conflicting thing. If you read the first line of that press release, worldwide shipments of VR headsets were down 33.7% year over year in the second quarter of 2018, according to IDC's own tracking stuff. They said they expect it to be a, quote, temporary setback as the VR market finds its legs. Arrival of new products such as the Oculus Go and the HTC Vive Pro and new brands should find a positive outlook for quarters ahead. I'm not as optimistic as they are. Oculus Go has been out for several months at least, so it should have been included in kind of these quarterly numbers already. Not that it can't grow or take off later than that. Let's see, what did they say? Screenless viewers brought a lot of attention to VR in the early days. Those are the ones that you could just buy the attachment that you add your phone into, like the Samsung and Google devices. However, since then, that declined, shrinking from 1 million to 409,000 units. So if you want an idea of what Gear VR has been doing, that should give you some indication as well. And then tethered headsets were down 37%. Those are the Vive and the Oculus Rift. So, I don't know. They say standalone VR headsets. So like the Oculus Go, the one that doesn't need a computer, isn't a thing where you attach a phone to, grew 400%. But that's because they're basically starting from zero at the beginning of the year. I still think the VR market will take off. I think it will still be AR that really lights the world on fire. But, IDC has been doing this for a long time. So if they actually say that there's positive outlook for it, then I guess I'll believe them, but it's hard to feel that way when you see 33% drop in quarterly sales. That's significant.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's see what happens between now and the end of the year. I'm really curious what Christmas, like holiday sales look like in VR, especially at the low end of the market. I'd also like to see some new games. I'd also like to see some games with some more depth. I would also like a pony. But as delightful as it might be to discuss pony acquisition on This Week in Computer Hardware, we should probably talk about where you can find Twit. If this is your first time listening to, not Twit, it's a totally different podcast, but we're on the Twit network. And if you go to twit.tv/TWICH or Twitch, you'll be able to get all the links to download the show, all of our older episodes, and information about Ryan and myself. We like to talk about the hardware. We do it each and every week here at twit.tv/twitch. And you can subscribe on your favorite podcatcher, whether it's audio or video that you're looking for. Mr. Ryan Schrout can be found bringing the real world results, the benchmarking mayhem. He is keeping it real over at pcper.com and trying to make sure you don't feel angry after buying something. because maybe it's just not as good as the marketing said it was. You can find me over at TechThing, TechThing.com. And when I'm in a home theater-y kind of mood, at AVXL.com, the podcast I host with Robert Herron. And I'm actually down in San Diego right now going to Cedia, which is the big installers gathering. It's like CES for people that install way over the top home theater systems. And I'm looking forward to getting my nerd on because there's some amazingly cool stuff going on here. So we'll talk about that a little bit next week. Right now, though, I got to thank each and every one of you for listening to Mr. Ryan and myself, and invite you to come back next week for the next episode of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll catch you next week.